Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, we'll hear a replay of one of our first shows, number 16, from June 2008. It's called Women, War, and Violence. A couple of the current affairs references are a little dated. President Ahmadinejad of Iran is long gone and forgotten. But don't worry, there's always some other guy we can call the Hitler of the Middle East. How about President Assad of Syria? He'll do. Anyway, I think the show has held up pretty well. It reminds us that if the first casualty of war is truth, the second casualty is civilians, and civilian women are especially hard hit. Here we go. First, let's hear from documentary filmmaker Lisa F. Jackson on the Congo.
In modern warfare, civilians are intentionally targeted. At the turn of the century, 90% of the casualties were military, and now 90% of the casualties are civilian. And a huge number of those are women and girls who are not killed. They are raped, and they are invisible statistics in modern conflict. Well, the Democratic Republic of Congo, we probably remember better as Zaire, the scene of the rumble in the jungle. Was it Ali Frazier? Yeah. But it was a Belgian colony in the late 1800s, and it was completely pillaged by King Leopold, who just sacked the country, taking out rubber and ivory and killing half the native population. There are photographs from that era that show guys in pith helmets holding baskets full of hands, because people, you know, if you didn't meet your quota for the rubber barons, your hands were amputated. So it has a huge, long history of just being sacked and desecrated by the First World. It's an incredibly rich country. It's bordered by nine different countries, all of whom variously, Angola, Rwanda, Burundi, Sudan, have all come across the borders to pillage its incredible resources, which include minerals, petroleum, diamonds, and a mineral called coltan, which has become my sort of pet issue. Coltan is a mineral that without which you cannot make a Sony PlayStation, a remote control, a laptop computer, or a cell phone. And it can be argued that there is the blood of Congolese women on your cell phone. So what is going on now, particularly in eastern Congo, is a resource war, where in the last 10 or 12 years, over 5 million people have died. And when you look at that number, it's 10 Darfurs have happened in the Congo. But it's a war in slow motion. It's an invisible war that has not gotten the media attention that Darfur has. I'm not quite sure why that is. Maybe Darfur is, you know, you can attach the term genocide to Darfur, and a lot of people get all excited, and attach George Clooney, and that, you know, triples the excitement. But nobody yet is really talking about what's going on in Congo and the First World's complicity in what is going on in Congo. So I chose to tell the story of that poor, conflict-racked country through the voices of its women. A little bit of my own backstory. I was gang raped when I was in my 20s and really didn't talk about it too much. The three men who attacked me in Washington, D.C. were never found. The statute of limitations has since expired, so it was something that I got over. It sort of colored my perspective on a lot of things for the rest of my life. So I thought it only fair in asking these women to tell me about the worst thing that had ever happened to them, to tell them a little bit about my own backstory. So every woman I interviewed in the film, and there were dozens and dozens of them, I told them first about my own gang rape. And they couldn't believe it. They asked me about the war that was happening in my country. How could a woman like me suffer like they had? I mean, I don't want to compare it at all. If in a country that is at peace. And I basically said that women everywhere are potential victims of sexual violence. And So they told me their stories with such frankness and such pulverizing detail. And I think a lot of them were telling me their stories because I was the first one who had asked, who listened to them without judgment and with compassion. And this was not something that they were used to. When people talk about, when the rare person talks about rape in the war in the Congo, they talk about widespread rape. And I think the terms need to be changed. It's systematic rape. Systematic rape by not only a lot of the current problem in the Congo, in eastern Congo, started after the Rwandan genocide in 94, 95. And tens of thousands of Hutu genociders flooded from Rwanda over the border into Congo, where they were actually supported by huge amounts of U.S. aid. There was a huge camp that was set up in eastern Congo to accommodate these. They saw them as refugees. But anyway, tens of thousands have remained in those mountains and are responsible for 60-70% of the atrocities. But there are likewise militias from Uganda and from Burundi, and the Congolese army itself are raping the women. And the stories that you hear, they commonly start, it was the middle of the night, and they broke into our homes. And the rapes are just unspeakable and unimaginable in the level of brutality. The women are gang raped in front of their families. They are mutilated, and with the intention not of killing them. So if a soldier puts a rifle and fires it into a woman's vagina, it's to destroy her femaleness and not to kill her. They do it intentionally not to kill her, but that she will become incontinent. She will be leaking urine and feces. She is rejected by her family. She is kicked out of her village. They often die from sort of the, you know, infections that result from the rapes. But in eastern Congo, there were only two hospitals that can deal with this condition, which is called its traumatic fistula. And sometimes they will walk for weeks, months through the bush to get to these hospitals, and multiple operations are required to stitch them back together. Some of them will stay in the hospitals for 2 or 3 years and still not be whole. When I say systematic, it is a strategy of the war. It's cheaper than bullets, and it guarantees that you are destroying the center of the culture. In a lot of, well, in eastern Congo, I'll speak specifically, the women are the center. They raise the children, they work the fields, they nurture, they keep the family together. And when the woman is destroyed, she is kicked out of her village. She often has 4, 5, 6 children who she then has to care for and is unable to care for. The children become then pickings for the militia. They're conscripted as child soldiers. They become slaves in the very coltan mines that are the source of this whole conflict. And the culture falls apart. So that's why I say it's systematic. And the International Rescue Committee, the International Committee of the Red Cross, I mean, there are many NGOs that have done, have looked at this problem and will agree that what is going on is not opportunistic rape. It's intentional. The humiliation, it's not only the physical destruction of the woman, but when she is raped by 10 soldiers in front of her village and her husband is made to watch, in a way, the husbands are psychologically raped also. I mean, they are shamed. They have not been able to protect their family. And that's a lot of the reason for the subsequent abandonment. And yes, I heard stories from girls as young as 8 and 10, women in their 70s. There was a woman who was 78 years old who was raped by 4 militia. And again, they have uniforms. They come in the night, so the women don't know. Are they Congolese? Are they Rwandese? But she said to these men, "You can't rape me. I'm an old woman." And they said to her, "You're not too old for us." I mean, that's another tremendous problem in the Congo. There is a culture of impunity there where rape goes unpunished. There are military officers very high in President Kabila's cabinet who are known rapists. And there's no criminal justice system. The jails don't have locks. If you are arrested for sexual violence, a bribe of $2 or $3, you'll walk free. The other rapes, the ones that are committed by foreign militias, you can put the responsibility on not only the foreign governments, but I think on multinational corporations who depend on the resources in the Congo and are using these militia to maintain the chaos necessary to exploit those resources. You know, look at Motorola, look at Nokia, look at Sony. You know, we all bear some complicity. We all are slightly responsible. So where to point the finger? I own a cell phone. How responsible am I? You know, rape is always part of a laundry list. It's way down on the list. And somebody needs to stand trial in the world criminal court for sexual violence so that some precedent can be established that says this is a crime, this is a war crime, rape is a crime of war.
Last month on this program, Dr. Michael Parenti discussed how and why the media push some stories and suppress other equally newsworthy ones. In the 1990s, when Parenti was speaking, it was Bosnia, 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 and the lousy, no-good, rotten Serbian tyrants who are killing Bosnia. Bosnia we heard plenty about, but not Angola, still less Mozambique, where millions had died in wars controlled by our very own CIA. Not news. Same with heads of state. From time to time, the U.S. government decides to overthrow the government of another country it finds annoying. Maybe not immediately, but at the next convenient opportunity. According to Parenti, the best clue a decision has been made is that, all of a sudden, our media and then we spend lots of time talking about what a villain that country's head of state is. At the time Parenti spoke, we were bad-mouthing three figures: Noriega of Panama, Saddam Hussein of Iraq, and Gaddafi of Libya. Parenti was great when he mocked Americans' obsession with Gaddafi. Gaddafi, 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 Gaddafi gonna get yo mama, Gaddafi under the bed. Fast forward to today, who is our Gaddafi? Aha, you say, President Ahmadinejad of Iran. Excellent, go to the head of the class. I'll also accept Chavez of Venezuela, yes. Possibly the anti-Ahmadinejad media forgot to mention that in Iran, unlike the U.S., the office of the president carries little power. About 25 Ayatollahs are above Ahmadinejad in the organizational chart. He's not the head of state, and the Iranian president's powers are entirely in domestic affairs. He has little influence on foreign policy. Thus, his views on Israel are of no more importance than the views of, say, the U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development on Israel. But let's turn from people back to places. Humanitarian disasters? Darfur, Darfur, Darfur. And not a peep about Iraq or the Congo, as filmmaker Lisa Jackson also notes. Yesterday, I drove past a house of worship. On its lawn was that familiar green and white sign, Darfur. What about Iraq? With 1 million civilians killed, another 5 million driven out of their homes, 2 million of them now refugees in other countries. Did I mention a cholera epidemic in the capital? What about the Congo? With well over 1 million killed in a war for oil, diamonds, and, a new one on me, coltan. What about the Congo, where a new implement of war has been devised, exclusively for use on civilians? Systematic rape, followed by lifetime damage to the victim's body and social ostracism. Count the humanitarian disaster lawn signs and bumper stickers on your next trip home. How many are for the Congo or for Iraq? Not a story. It's easy to imagine political reasons for suppressing this story from Iraq. After all, the humanitarian disaster was set in motion and aggravated by the United States of America. Maybe we can see a political reason, too, for the silence on the Congo. Damn it, AT&T needs that coltan.
Fortunately, the Congo situation is beginning to become better known in the U.S.
For this, thanks go to, among others, filmmaker Lisa Jackson, whom we just heard,
to HBO for making Jackson's film The Greatest Silence available to a wider audience, to playwright Eve Ensler and the organization V-Day, who have done much to make the world aware of the problem. Thanks to, get this, Glamour magazine, which published a long and fine article by Ensler on the subject. And as always, thanks to the alternative media. Let's cheer up a bit with a song. The lyrics aren't all that cheerful, but the beat is, well, upbeat. And since we've been hearing from strong women fighting back against depression, who better for a musical interlude than Bonnie Raitt? This recording sounds like it was made on location at a rally by a fan in the audience. Sounds like she recorded it on her cell phone. There's Coltan again. But what the recording lacks in audio fidelity, it more than makes up for in spirit. Here's Bonnie.
God is great, God is good. He guards your neighborhood. Though it's generally understood, not quite the way you would. You try to take a slack, you stay awake and you watch your back. Something happens every now and then. Someone breaks into the promised land. Oh, boy, boy, this world is not your toy. This world is long on hunger. This world is short on joy. You've done. What's good about a world in which war rages at a fever pitch and people die for the little things, a little corn and a little beans. Whoa, boy, boy, this world is not your toy. This world is long on hunger. This world is short on joy. Long on hunger. Short on joy. How much longer you gonna keep the world hungry and bored? You measure your peace with guns. Your progress is in megatons. Well, who's left when the war is won? A soldier of a misfortune. A soldier of an angry call. Soldiers on foreign soil. Well, we're not here to fight your war, 'cause we know what you're fighting for. This world is long on hunger. This world is short on joy. Long on hunger. Short on joy. How much longer? Keep the world hungry and bored.
What makes 2008 different from, say, 1918 is that today's war dead are overwhelmingly innocent civilians. As Lisa F. Jackson correctly notes, in World War I, the war dead were 90% combatants, 10% civilians. Today, the war dead are 10% combatants and 90% civilians. How anyone, knowing this, could agree to join the military is beyond me. Perhaps most people don't know this until they put on a uniform and get shipped to the Middle East. Then they find out. So if your main military strategy is to attack and demoralize your opponent's civilian population, then rape would seem a more or less logical and reasonable weapon of war. Certainly no worse than burning civilian women alive with white phosphorus, maiming them with cluster bombs and landmines, crushing them under the rubble of their houses, crushing them under tank treads, shooting their husbands and children in front of them, or vaporizing them with the warhead of a Hellfire missile. Who wants to argue about which techniques are okay and which not okay for destroying innocent women and children? First, explain to me why any of it is okay. Wartime rape is not the only bad thing that happens to civilian women. In the Congo, rapes are arguably the acts of the enemy, or outlaws, or renegades. But some of the horrors women are made to suffer come not from criminals or the enemy, but from the established order itself. In this installment of New World Notes, we've referred many times to the misery inflicted on the people of Iraq, men and women alike. But in Iraq, additional misery has been inflicted on the women citizens, not by Al-Qaeda or even by U.S. soldiers, but by the new U.S.-approved government of Iraq, the new U.S.-written constitution, and the economic hardships created by the never-ending U.S. occupation. The misery doesn't generally involve forcible rape, though of course that happens too, but the impoverishment we have brought to a once prosperous country has driven millions of Iraqi women into prostitution, a most un-Islamic behavior that guarantees the women not only lifetime social ostracism, but violent death when caught by the country's many vigilantes of holiness. All men, of course. And the new U.S.-written constitution destroyed many of the rights women had enjoyed under Saddam Hussein. In this recording of April 2008, Iraqi activist and women's rights advocate Inar Mohammed discusses with Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman how the rights of Iraq's women have plummeted downhill since the U.S. deposed Saddam and brought freedom and democracy to their country.
It's a global movement now against violence of against women, and we think that the story of violence against women of Iraq is already turning into a forgotten story. This occupation of Iraq has turned the society into fighting groups, and they're all right-wing groups that have agenda against women, and it's hard to witness the women of your country suffer under that. For example, the main opposition group is a misogynist group that administers mass killings of women in the cities of Iraq, and it was publicized that only in the city of Basra, 130-something women are being killed every year because of these militias. And in the same time, the group that are in power have written for us a constitution that legalizes polygamy and legalizes also pedophilia and all kinds of violence against women.
This is the
new constitution in Iraq, which was described to be the most democratic doctrine in the Middle East for an Islamist country, allows Sharia articles to work against the family law that we used to have in Iraq. In Iraq, polygamy, like multiple marriages, one man can marry four women, that was restricted in the past decade. While now, under this new constitution, one man can marry four women, and that would be legal. One man can marry small children, and that would be legal. And that is called democracy in Iraq. Other than that, the new militias that are ruling in Iraq, part of their political agenda is violence against women, killings of women. And this is all a new story in Iraq, a story that is not mentioned over the news, because because it is not suitable for the new administration or the old administration in the U.S. to say that they have brought forward a very violent era to Iraq, an era where we are under the rule of the most religious fundamentalist institution, where women are second-rate citizens and violence against them is not even considered news. That's why I am here. We want this story to be heard all around the world. Women of Iraq do not deserve this, and they need support. We have heard from V-Day a lot during these years, and we need to hear more from the women of the U.S., of the world, and also the progressive of the world to be supporting us in Iraq.
You recently testified in Canada to accept more Iraqi refugees?
I have met parliamentarians and told them that when a woman is suffering because of militias killing them, when women have a constitution that treats them as second-rate citizens, when I even gave an example that a young woman 5 days ago in Sadr City was found in an intimate situation with a man, and the members of Sadr militia held her by the hand and made her walk bare naked in front of all of the city. This kind of humiliation against women is something new in Iraq, and it comes with the new democracies that were promised to us. This should not happen, and when a woman has to prostitute herself to get money and feed her children in Iraq, this is also something new. Women of Iraq need to be saved at this point from the very barbaric attack that was on us by this so-called liberation of Iraq.
Is prostitution growing in Iraq?
Prostitution, I would say without hesitation, it includes almost 20% of the women in Iraq, and this is also a news story.
20%?
Some of it is formal and most of it is informal, and you are killed on the spot if you are found. But who will feed your children? You know, we have almost 1 million widows in Iraq. They do not have any source of income, and there are no jobs for these women. How are they going to feed their children? For those immigrants who are in Syria and in Jordan, and there are almost 50 to 70,000 women who are vulnerable to that situation, and many of them practicing it. And once you practice it, you are wanted among honor killing within your tribe, within your community, and you're just stuck there. And all of this is violence against women that is not being acknowledged by the world. Nobody is doing anything for the women of Iraq.
How about these issues in the Iraqi refugee community in places like Syria?
In Syria, we hear that some women, it reached to the point where they are begging strangers passing by to exploit them sexually so they can feed their children. You know, women of Iraq were not in this situation, I would say, 6 years ago. We did not have to do this. We did not have to go through humiliation, through prostitution. We did not have to beg in the embassies to be accepted in the Western world when the attack on our lives came from the West.
For the talk by Lisa F. Jackson, thanks to Mind Over Matters and producer Mike McCormick out in rainy Seattle. For the interview with Inar Mohammed, thanks to Amy Goodman and democracynow.org. Thanks for listening to this encore performance of New World Notes from back in 2008. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, practice peace, keep the faith, baby. Please come back again next week, and good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are.